The Bible says that the meek shall inherit the earth. Well, for now, one particularly meek kid is burning up children's bestseller lists. That kid is Greg Heffley, the smart-mouthed sad sack who's the lead character in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid book series. The stories revolve around the various embarrassments he experiences at the hands of his family and his school friends. The fourth book in the series, called Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, has just been released. The author is Jeff Kenney. Listen as he reads a diary entry about the world of those tantalizing supermarket tabloids.
Mom says tabloids are full of lies, but I think there's some really important stuff in those things. Grandma is always buying tabloids, even though Mom doesn't approve. A few weeks ago, Grandma wasn't answering her phone, so Mom got worried and drove over to Grandma's to see if she was okay. Grandma was fine, but she wasn't picking up her phone because of something she read. And we see Grandma saying, "Cordless telephones erase the memory of the elderly." But when Mom asked Grandma where she got her information, Grandma said, "The New York Times?"
I spoke with Jeff Kenney earlier today. He said he set out to write a book for adults. I asked him how he got started.
After college, I really wanted to be a newspaper cartoonist, and what happened was I sent out my work every few months and got a pile of rejection letters back, and eventually I realized that I didn't have the artistic talents to draw at that level. I thought that I could write at that level, but I couldn't draw at that level. And so what I decided to do was to write and draw as a seventh grade boy, because that was sort of where I maxed out, and that's how Greg Heffley, my character, was born.
Now, you say that you maxed out in seventh grade, which, of course, I don't believe.
Right.
You've sold too many books for us to buy that one. But is there something about the mind of a seventh grader that was particularly delicious as a writer and as an illustrator?
I think it was less about the mind of a seventh grader and more about the drama that exists in middle school. The fact that you really and truly do have kids who are twice the size of other kids and at various stages of development. And I thought it just feels like a dangerous place, middle school. So I thought it was an unexplored or underappreciated place for comedy.
Well, I thought it would be a good idea to get input from the kids who actually read your books. So I asked young readers to send in their questions. We actually did a shout out on the radio, and we got almost 400 responses, so many.
Wow.
That I thought we could do much of the interview with the questions that had landed in our inbox. What do you think?
Great. Let's go for it.
Were you a wimpy kid?
I was an average kid, but I certainly had my wimpy moments, and a lot of those have made their way into the books. When I was on the swim team as a kid, I used to hide out from my coach by going into the bathroom and hiding out in one of the stalls. And I would literally wrap myself in toilet paper so as not to get hypothermia. And I keep thinking that that's where Greg Heffley was born.
You wrapped yourself in toilet paper?
Can we not linger on this? What's the next question?
I just wonder how much toilet paper that would take.
True story.
Well, Paul Crabill of Elkhart, Indiana wants to know, why doesn't Greg ever win? And a similar question came from Heidi Miner. She says, why'd you make Greg's life so miserable?
I think most of Greg's unhappiness he brings upon himself. You know, you can't really pity this character. He's a little bit narcissistic, and he can be a crummy friend at times. But he's not a bad kid at all. He's just a not fully formed person.
A lot of kids asked about the font.
The font. Well, they caught me. I was trying to make it look like it was handwritten, but it's true. It's a font based on my handwriting.
And was that deliberate so the books would not look like traditional books?
Right. I wanted it to feel accessible also. And I think that when a kid opens my books, they feel like it's not too threatening.
A lot of kids asked about something that was actually in your first book, The Cheese Touch.
The cheese is part of the legend of the first book, where there's this piece of cheese that sits underneath the new hoop on the blacktop. And rather than just kicking it to the side or throwing it away, the kids let this kind of myth build up around the cheese until it becomes this, you know, object of terror where nobody can touch it or even go near it, or they'll become ostracized. And I got the idea from, you know, just from cooties. So I was trying to come up with something like nuclear cooties, you know, the middle school equivalent of cooties.
Something like that happened in your own life, though, involving cheese?
You know, what I remember is that when I was in the Boy Scouts, somebody was making the smaller kids do push-ups into a piece of cheese, you know, in a hallway. So maybe that's what inspired it.
Jeff Kenney, it has been fun to talk to you. And if you actually want to see more Q&A with Jeff Kenney, more questions, more answers from him at our website, you can find that at npr.org. And one last question before I let you go. What do you say to the parents who are ambivalent about this, who say that the books are just too snarky?
I think that there's stuff out there that's a whole lot more snarky. I think that my books are harmless and fun, and they get kids to read. And if anything, I think that these books are turning kids on to reading, and they're going to move on to more legitimate reading in the future. So I think that's a good thing.
Jeff Kenney, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Have we got a deal for you? If you're looking to buy a book, there's a price war on. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, over the past few days, the book industry has been reeling as it watches some of its hottest commodities drop to new lows.
The price war took off last week when Walmart, in a bid to compete with Amazon for the online market, cut its prices for online pre-orders of 10 upcoming bestsellers to $10. Amazon responded by bringing its price down to $10. So Walmart lowered the price to $9. Amazon followed suit. By Friday afternoon, Walmart dropped its price to $8.99. Then on Monday, Target joined the fray, announcing it too would sell online pre-orders for certain bestsellers at $8.99. Kelly Bastian is a spokesperson for Target.
So it's always our goal to be competitively priced, and we want our guests to know that they can get a great value at Target and on Target.com. So we followed the competition's price cuts last Friday and decided yesterday we should go ahead and match prices on these 10 books.
Now Walmart has taken another tiny step, lowering the price of most of these books by another penny. Al Greco, a Fordham University professor who studies the publishing business, says this price war could have a serious ripple effect on all booksellers.
This cuts into book buying at retail stores, supermarkets, convenience stores, the bookstore chains, especially hit hard will be the independent bookstores who are unable to discount to that level.
Ironically, says David Young, chairman and CEO of Hachette Book Group, this price war is focused on best-selling authors like John Grisham, Barbara Kingsolver, and other potentially lucrative books which provide the underpinning for the rest of the industry.
And so consequently, you are selling off, if you like, the family jewels. It's a strange thing. Most new products entering a market are sold at a premium, not at a discount. And that's the danger that we face with discounting the very things that should be the market leaders.
One of the authors whose books has been discounted is James Patterson. Patterson says he's concerned about how this price war could potentially affect what is published in the future. He compares the situation to the film industry.
If all new movies will come out this weekend, and imagine if somebody was selling DVDs of the same movie for $5, it kind of changes everything. And to some extent, they wouldn't be able to afford to make movies. So it's big stuff.
Shoppers at a Target store in Washington, D.C. today were vaguely aware of the book price wars, and many, like Nancy Bramson, said, yeah, they could get used to lower prices for books.
Yeah, if they're $8.99, yeah, that's better than Costco.
And that, says Hachette CEO David Young, is exactly what the book industry is afraid of.
This real aggressive price deflation is something that people will become more widely aware of, and then the acceptance of $10 being the price for a new book would have a very harmful effect on our business.
Young says he hopes the prices announced this week are only temporary and not the norm. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
If you're pregnant, have small children, or if you know someone who's given birth, or even if you've visited the childbirth section of a bookstore, you probably have seen the bevy of what to expect books. What to expect when you're expecting, what to expect the toddler years, what to eat when you're expecting. Well, a new book offers a different perspective. What to expect when you are expected. It's billed as a fetus's guide to the first three trimesters. And don't expect to find practical advice in these pages. However, you might find various oddities, and you'll definitely find some belly laughs. David Javerbaum wrote this book, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
Now, the cover of this book does look like it's in the family of What to Expect books, those books that are published by Workman Publishing Group.
Right, and those books, by the way, are a parody of mine. My book is What to Expect When You're Expected. It's the original. What to Expect When You're Expecting is a parody that's fooled, I think, up to 30 million people at this point. But my book, make no mistake, is the original.
You really are, as I understand, trying to help the folks that are in utero communicate in some way with those who are expecting them to enter the world at some point. Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, I was hoping that hopefully after reading this book, fetuses will emerge better prepared to handle some of the challenges of modern 21st century society. I have two kids of my own, and both times I would go to the hospital when they were born, I'd go to the maternity ward, and I would see this new generation being born. I call them Generation XXXY. And, you know, they're naked and they're screaming and they're incoherent. They're placed in an isolated part of the hospital for their own good and for the protection, I think, frankly, of the other people. And it was disturbing. As an American, I don't like seeing, you know, the next generation of Americans in that kind of condition. And so my hope is that this will help put them in a better place.
There's a very funny bit in the book about baby names. Do you have the book with you?
I do.
It starts on page 175. Let's go there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mind reading just a bit of that?
Absolutely. Your name has no doubt been the subject of much discussion between your parents. He likes Zoe. She thinks it sounds precious. She likes Samantha. He thinks it sounds quaint. They both like Morgan. The world thinks Morgan sounds stupid. So Morgan it is. That's the thing about your name. It's essentially genetic, determined by your parents as surely as your DNA. And though you may one day legally change it, in your heart, you will remain the same adorable newborn whose parents held you in their arms and repeated the phrase, "Hello, Wizu Maximus," over and over again.
Hmm. Now, you also go through name categories, and some of these are a lot of fun. Place names.
Place names, these are, you know, this has been common for years now. For boys, you have Bryce or Zion, Yellowstone. Carlsbad Caverns.
There's no one named Carlsbad Caverns.
Oh, well, I'm not sure where you're looking, Michelle, but where I'm from here in New York, a lot of newborns are named Carlsbad Caverns. And girls, you have London, Paris, Brussels, and Luxembourg City is actually a burgeoning name.
Known as Elsie.
Elsie would be a good nickname for that.
I want to ask you about one of the questions you pose in the book. Why do my parents blast Mozart at me every night when I'm just trying to sleep?
Yeah, that's a common thing. Your parents want the best for you, and they want you to be better than themselves and not suffer from the same failings that they believe that they have. And one of your parents' failings is that they never, ever listen to classical music. And so they're going to inflict their guilt about that on you. So you have to sit there and essentially get an involuntary 9-month subscription to your very own Mostly Mozart festival in there in a room with very bad acoustics. And the sad thing is there are so many other pieces of music that would be more appropriate in the fetal environment.
Such as?
I've Got You Under My Skin by Frank Sinatra would be a wonderful choice. You know, Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash. That's a very appropriate one for later. With or Without You. That's more for conjoined twins. But there's a lot of other songs that really can work, you know, in that environment.
David, it has been fun to talk to you. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Michelle.
David Javerbaum is the author of the book What to Expect When You're Expected, A Fetus's Guide to the First Three Trimesters, the first ever guide to pregnancy for the prenatal reader written by a former embryo. He writes for The Daily Show.
Ever hear of the acclaimed British novelist Jane Gardam? If not, our book critic Maureen Corrigan says you're in good company, even though Gardam has written over 20 novels and was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire this year in recognition of her literary achievements, and she's the only writer to have been twice awarded Britain's Whitbread Prize for the best novel of the year. Maureen has a review of Gardam's new novel, The Man in the Wooden Hat.
the best contemporary British writer you probably haven't heard of. That's how I identified Jane Gardam to those readers, especially those Anglophiles, who ask me for recommendations. There are many reasons to sing Gardam's praises, among them her off-the-beaten-track subjects, her outwardly polished, inwardly muddled characters, and her roller coaster tone that speeds from twee to tragic in a paragraph. But the latest occasion to celebrate Gardam is that at the age of 81, she's just added another superb novel to her canon. It's called The Man in the Wooden Hat, and it's a companion work to what many Gardam groupies consider her masterpiece, her 12th novel, Old Filth. Filth is a musty British acronym that stands for the phrase, "Failed in London, try Hong Kong." It was applied unkindly to describe public school-educated Brits who scurried to the far corners of the empire to make fortunes and careers they otherwise would have been shut out of in the mother country. The old filth of Gardam's 2004 novel is Sir Edward Feathers, a distinguished barrister who was born to English parents in the Far East and later became what was known as a Raj orphan when he was sent back alone to England as a child for his education. Given that early experience of separation, Feathers is, to put it mildly, an introvert. Send him on a solitary walk in his wellies, followed by a tumbler of whiskey, and he seems to be miserably contented. The only steady connection in his life was his wife Betty, who in Old Filth has died of a heart attack while planting tulip bulbs. The Man in a Wooden Hat is Betty's retrospective story of their marriage, and she's every bit Sir Edward's equal in terms of her enigmatic emotions and her tart worldview. Betty and Edward met in Hong Kong after World War II. The only child of British parents who died in a Japanese internment camp, Betty is primed to accept Edward's rather stiff proposal. She confesses to a girlfriend, however, that she's not sure she loves Edward, that she foolishly wants the moon. Here's what Betty's girlfriend says in reply. "You should want the moon. Don't do it. Don't go for a 40-watt bulb just because it looks pretty. You'll get stuck with it when it goes out. You are so loyal, and you'll soldier on in the dark forever afterwards." In a sense, the bulk of this new novel is a nuanced exploration of whether or not Betty's girlfriend was right. The Feathers' marriage has its blips of passion and its long, drowsy seasons of companionability, but infidelity and loss and bitter mutual dismay also mark the union. The overriding sadness of Betty's life is that because of an early hysterectomy, she can't have children. This is emotional territory that Gardam has visited before, most dramatically in her amazing 1991 novel in letters, The Queen of the Tambourine. There's a scene in that novel in which the prematurely menopausal heroine visits her doctor, and he chirpily asks how she's doing. "Things drying up nicely," he says. It's a tossed-off remark that I think captures the oddness of Gardam's signature tone, at once witty yet grotesque. Together, Old Filth and The Man in the Wooden Hat compose a vivid diptych of a marriage. You don't have to read Old Filth first, though you'll enjoy the plot surprises in this latest novel more if you do. Both novels, along with other gems from Gardam's backlist, are published in paperback in this country by Europa Editions, a small press founded just 5 years ago, which has been doing the Lord's work in terms of introducing European literary novels, many of them in translation, to an American readership. Europa's sleeper hit last year was French writer Muriel Barbery's wry novel, The Elegance of the Hedgehog. I wouldn't be surprised if The Man in the Wooden Hat sweeps up still more accolades for Europa and for the quietly renowned Gardam.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Man in the Wooden Hat by Jane Gardam.